listening to Saturday Night on the Circle on 93 WIPC. I know there
must be something better. Welcome back to Saturday Night on the Circle. I'm your host, Ethan Hatcher. That's producer Carl on the board doing an excellent job. I don't know how to begin this week's show because, unfortunately, scenes of chaos unfolded on 4th of July celebrations in cities nationwide. Booming sounds of fireworks were mistaken for gunshots, sending panicked crowds fleeing for cover in Orlando, Harrisburg, and Washington. And who would have thought that they were the lucky ones? I'm your host, Ethan Hatcher. On Monday morning, of course, we know in Highland Park, a gunman killed 7 people and injured others who remain in critical condition. Even in our own city of Indianapolis, a gunman fired more than 50 shots at a 4th of July party at 38th and Arlington, shooting into a bouncy house, striking 2 kids and an adult. Fortunately, no fatalities. But tonight, I welcome host of the Gun Guy Show and the one and only Guy Relford back onto the program. And specifically, Guy, I'd like to talk about this Highland Park twerp who was known to law enforcement prior to the attack. Although many facts on the ground are different, this reminds me of the young Michigan school shooter whose negligent parents contributed to a tragedy. Do you think the father will incur any civil or criminal liability for contributing to the circumstances which allowed his son to commit this heinous crime?
Yeah, civil, I put a much higher likelihood on that, Ethan, because, again, I mean, anybody can file a lawsuit. Right.
Sure.
You don't go through a grand jury process or a prosecutor deciding to file charges. So, yeah, I wouldn't be a bit surprised if you see litigation in a civil sense. In terms of prosecution, this is I agree with you. It's reminiscent of the Michigan situation. And in fact, those parents, as you know, are being prosecuted in criminal court. Having said that, it has one very significant difference, which is the shooter in Highland Park was an adult legally, right? Was over 18. So he's not legally, right, under the control of his parents any longer. That significantly impacts the legal issues, particularly when the parents wouldn't necessarily be prosecuted for doing something. It's more likely to be prosecuted for not doing something. And when you talk about crimes of omission versus commission, those are always tougher to prove, and there are very few criminal penalties for not having done something. What the dad did, and I think this is where a lot of people are questioning his role in the whole thing, was he actually endorsed the kid's FOID card, the firearm owner's identification card system they have in Illinois. And you're basically endorsing the person to say, yeah, he's okay to have a firearm. And this is after there'd already been some troubling incidents involving weapons and involving threats. So that's where the focus may likely be.
And those incidents you're talking about occurred in April and September of 2019. In April, someone alerted police after alerting that he had attempted to kill himself, this suspect.
Right.
According to authorities, police spoke with his parents as well, in which they learned a mental health professional was handling the situation, quote unquote. In September of the same year, a family member told police that the suspect had a knife collection and was going to kill everyone, according to authorities. They responded to the scene and removed 16 knives from the suspect's home. And then it was after that incident that the father went back, retrieved the weapons, and sponsored his son's firearm owner's identification card.
Yeah.
So that's where what seems to me some negligence here. And it's displayed by many members of the family. The uncle was quoted by the New York Post as saying the father did nothing wrong for sponsoring his son's firearm, you know, application after these incidents occurred. Wholesale dismissive of the implications there. That's sad.
Yeah, well, no, completely agreed. But you used an important word in that, which is negligence. And typically, simple negligence, that can be a basis for a civil lawsuit, but it's typically not a crime. Now, there is something called criminal negligence or gross negligence, depending on the state, but that has to rise to a very high level. It's more than simple negligence. It's like gross negligence is heedless disregard for the consequences of your action, something like that, which is a pretty high bar. Typically, negligence just gets you sued. It doesn't get you sent to jail. For instance, if I run a stop sign and kill somebody, right? Assuming I'm not drunk or something along those lines, I'm just an idiot who ran a stop sign. That gets me sued, but it doesn't get me sent to jail. I was still a knucklehead. I was negligent. But that's why it's more a basis of civil liability rather than going to jail. And frankly, if we sent all knuckleheads to jail, we wouldn't have many people walking around on the streets, right? Sure. So you can be a knucklehead, you can be negligent and still not commit a crime. That's why I say civil liability is much more likely than actual criminal prosecution or conviction. It's not out of the question. And we may see them go down that road. But again, the Michigan situation was fundamentally different.
Yeah.
Because they actually bought the gun for the kid. And they were told about these threats he'd made and very alarming drawings he'd made in school. He had the gun with him in school. They refused to take him home and said, no, we have things to do. We're leaving him here. And never went about finding the location of the gun, which he had in his backpack at the school. And he was a minor under their legal control. All those things that make that, in my mind, a more egregious situation.
So what was the breakdown of events here? Because he was known to law enforcement. He was known to members of his family to be a threat to them and himself. What can we do to strengthen red flag laws? What, if any, laws were, you know, misapplied here that could have potentially prevented this tragedy? Because this is becoming a recurring theme, and yeah, it's extremely troubling.
It is. And look, they just passed a red flag law in Illinois in 2019. So they had a red flag law. Now, theirs is structured where family members are the most likely to actually report someone as being dangerous and trigger the proceedings. But here they did that. They did that when they said that he had tried to commit suicide. And they did that when they said that he had threatened to kill everyone in the home. So the question then becomes, all right, once the parents make that call, why weren't there any proceedings under the red flag law initiated by law enforcement or by authorities generally at that point? Not unlike when the mother of our FedEx shooter here in Indianapolis red flagged her son. She went to the police department and said, this guy just bought a shotgun and says he wants to commit suicide by cop. And police went to their home, seized his shotgun from him, but Ryan Mears' office never filed right. The red flag proceeding. So the bat's no good if you don't take it off your shoulder and take a swing. And it was true with our FedEx shooting, and it certainly appears to be true with the Highland Park shooting as well.
And that was going to be my question, because in our circumstance, we could definitely point the finger at Ryan Mears and his wholesale negligence in running that office. Is there a prosecutor in Illinois who's responsible for this then?
I'm sure that question's being asked. It's exactly the right question, Ethan, because someone said, all right, hold on. You had two different reports, threatened to kill everyone in the home, threatened to kill himself, and yet he was still allowed to go forward and possess these firearms. Now, their statute, their red flag law is a little different than ours, which is even if he's successfully, quote unquote, red flag, they expire in Illinois, they expire automatically in 6 months. And so when you look at the timing of those earlier incidents, had he been red flagged back then, he would have been able to possess firearms at the time of the shooting, unless the parents went back and attempted to have it renewed. And the other thing is, too, once the red flag order expires after 6 months, you're no longer prohibited from going in and buying guns. So that's another big variable in all of this, which had they red flagged him, it may likely have expired by the time of these shootings.
Now, one of the things that I thought was interesting, did you hear that the father and son had discussed mass shootings the very night before? Right. And so they were discussing the Copenhagen shooter who had shot three people last Sunday. And the kid was quoted as saying, yeah, that guy's an idiot. And he was also saying people like that commit mass shootings to amp up the people that want to ban all guns. So it's interesting that there seems to be a pre-existing culture there in the home. And then also the family refusing to own up to any level of responsibility, whether that's the dad, whether that's the uncle. And then, you know, saying that they were perfectly within, you know, their rights and it was a good thing that, you know, in essence, the father sponsored his son's gun app or firearm owner's identification.
Exactly. You know, I mean, I get the need and the desire to cover your ass. You know, I understand that.
Sure.
At the same time, to me, they're coming across as very callous, and that doesn't help their cause. If it were me, I'd be hunkered down, issue a formal statement, essentially an apology, you know, grieving for the victims and their families, and then shut the hell up. The fact that they're out there shrugging their shoulders, apparently saying we didn't do anything wrong, I don't think that helps their cause. If I were there advising them on all those things, they would not be making those statements. I don't think they're doing themselves any good.
Well, and to think that this nutcase could have unleashed on a completely separate event. You know, the mind shudders to think about the consequence of that. But that wasn't the only attack. There were more than 18 people, Guy, injured in shootings across the United States on just 4th of July celebrations. I don't remember this happening when I was a kid in the 90s. It seems like a different culture.
Well, culture is the exact right word. Because, you know, we've always had firearms. In fact, we typically had less restrictions on firearms than we have now, particularly in those states that have banned this or banned that. Yet we continue to have these. And so you mentioned culture. That's exactly what we ought to be focused on. It's a cultural problem. The respect for human life, the education on right from wrong, the ramifications of making wrong decisions, where people get messages on right and wrong, whether it's in school or from their parents or in church or where, you know, where those places where I got those messages, where you got those messages, people aren't receiving those messages anymore. So in my mind, that's exactly where we ought to be focused.
I mean, in Indianapolis, going back to what I mentioned at the start of the segment, there was a nutcase they're still looking for. Business owners have offered $5,000 for information leading to the arrest of this person who fired more than 50 shots into a crowd, specifically into a bouncy house where kids were having fun at this 4th of July celebration at 38th in Arlington. And they injured two kids, an adult. Unfortunately, there were no fatalities, but that's scary, Guy.
It is scary. And, you know, a lot of times people ask me the questions, usually rhetorical when they're asking me, but people ask me the questions, well, gosh, Guy, you carry a gun everywhere? Yeah, I carry a gun everywhere. I can legally carry. I carry a gun. They're like, well, why would you need a gun at the grocery store? Well, how about the Walmart shooting in Texas? Why would you carry a gun in church? Oh, how about the Sutherland Springs mass shooting? Why would you carry a gun at a kid's birthday party? Well, how about 38th and Arlington? So you don't know where evil is going to rear its ugly head. You don't know where people are going to target you. And that's why I like having the capacity of defending myself and my family. Doesn't mean I'm paranoid. Doesn't mean I'm afraid. Just means I want to have that ability to defend myself. And that's because you never know where these things are going to occur.
Why don't we see more good guys with guns, quote unquote, because that's, you know, the phrase that's often bandied about in these specifically mass shooter events? Because I acknowledge that, you know, the right to own a firearm definitely has come in handy for, you know, people who have been mugged on the street, for a home defense. But you don't really see it exercise so much in these mass shooting events. Where's that?
Well,
happening?
Because where they've been interrupted by a good guy, they don't turn into mass shootings. So they don't get described in the media as mass shootings. And we just had one where it got no media coverage in the general media. A woman, I want to say in Virginia, was at I believe it was a mall. Guy showed up with a gun, clearly prepared to perform a mass shooting, fired once or twice. A woman drew her legally owned gun, shot him in the head and killed him. Event over.
Where was this?
That was like 2 weeks ago. I want to say Virginia. It was out east somewhere. And this just occurred. It got no mainstream media coverage. And that's not the first time. There was a mass shooting interrupted in Minnesota not long ago. But those don't get the same kind of media coverage because, again, they don't turn into mass shootings because they were interrupted by that good guy with the gun. They just don't get nearly the media coverage. And that's why, I mean, you're squinting at me a little unbelieving right now, but no. That's only because the mainstream media doesn't cover them. And believe me, because of the circles that I run in, I tend to find out about them, but finding them in the media, finding any coverage on them is almost impossible because the media chooses not to cover them.
No, I'm legitimately surprised that there's a lack of awareness about those attacks because you'd think that would be more publicized.
Oh, yeah, but that's not the agenda, right? The mainstream media has a pre-existing agenda of attacking our constitutional freedoms. We see that left and right.
Well, unfortunately, Guy, we are way over time, so I got to cut the conversation short, but thank you for taking time out of your schedule to, you know, share the conversation with us in the wake of a horrific tragedy in, you know, in our city and in Illinois as well.
Absolutely. Always a pleasure.
All right. Thank you. This is 93 WIBC. You're listening to Saturday Night on The Circle. Stay tuned for more.
I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire.
You're listening to Saturday Night on The Circle on 93 WIBC.
Everybody, just when gas prices were heading down, a natural gas pipeline exploded into flames this week in Houston, probably not doing any favors to your energy bills. Oh, wait, that's not good news. You're listening to Saturday Night on The Circle. I'm your host, Ethan Hatcher.
That's producer Carl. Beep, 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 beep. Pushing those buttons, doing all the things to make the show possible, running the board and doing a spectacular job of it, if I say so myself. So this natural gas pipeline exploded southwest of Houston on Thursday, and it sent a towering flame of fire and smoke high into the sky that could be seen for more than 30 miles, according to helicopters that responded to the blaze. The blast took place in a rural field in Fort Bend County. A fire marshal responding to the scene confirmed that no structures were immediately threatened by the fire, but Texas, like so much of the Midwest right now, is facing dry conditions from lack of rain, which could make field fires easy to flare up. Fortunately, that was not the case here. They were able to keep the blaze under control. Texas produces the most fossil fuels in the nation, the blaze was extinguished around 12:10 p.m. Took about 2.5 hours to extinguish, according to the Texas Railroad Commission, which regulates oil and gas drilling and energy pipelines in the state. Firefighters sprayed water on nearby fields until the flow of natural gas was stopped, snuffing the fire. So that's how they kept the field fires under control. And Andrew Keese, the Railroad Commission spokesperson, said the agency is conducting an investigation into the explosion and fire. It's very important to remember that these price increases we're seeing aren't just fueled by a spike in demand during a time of tightening supplies caused by Russian geopolitical aggression. They're driven by an administration with professed hostility to American energy production that was exhibited as far back as the campaign trail and continued once he took office. Joe Biden and his political opponents or appointments throughout the administration have created an environment that disincentivizes expansion of current production, and those choices have real adverse effects on you. Here's Biden professing his hostility to American energy production. And I have no sound. What's going on? Let's try that again. Are we up? Stop. Somebody has muted me natively. Let's try this.
No more drilling on federal lands. No more drilling, including offshore. No ability for the oil industry to continue to drill, period.
Would there be any place for fossil fuels, including coal and fracking, in a Biden administration?
No, we would work it out. We would make sure it's eliminated.
I guarantee you, we're going to end fossil fuel.
What about, say, stopping fracking and stopping pipeline infrastructure?
There's no question I'm in favor of banning fracking.
No more, no new fracking.
We are going to get rid of fossil fuels.
Have a transition from the oil industry, yes.
So there's Biden in his own words, and that's, you know, not hyperbolic. That's not taken out of context. That's what he was saying on the campaign trail. You heard Kamala Harris there as well. They are opposed to American energy production. So not only do we have the current strain on supply and increased demand, not only do we have the additional exacerbating factor of the war in Ukraine, which certainly doesn't help things. I mean, it's not the primary driving factor that Biden would like to describe it, but it's not helping things either. And then you have the hostility to American energy production coming from this administration. But not only that, they have a pathological disdain for you, and they can't even be transparent about the measures that they're allegedly taking to lower domestic prices. So the radicals in this administration, like I said, they have a pathological disdain for you, and nowhere is that more clear than their utter lack of concern about ballooning energy prices. Not only are they unconcerned about the high prices, but the sick bastards are actually pleased because in their perverse mindset, they believe it helps accomplish the transition from traditional energy resources. And this, according to Reuters, in the midst of the energy crisis, more than 5 million barrels have been diverted from the strategic reserve to foreign assets. The historic U.S. emergency reserve released to lower domestic fuel prices that's what the strategic release was for. But 5 million barrels were exported to Europe and Asia last month, even as the U.S. gasoline and diesel prices hit record highs. So help me out here, Carl, because I'm really struggling. How does releasing millions of barrels of oil from the strategic reserve to foreign countries help lower domestic fuel prices?
Well, it helps the foreign countries.
There we go, but not the domestic kind.
Well, I mean,
and that's what the release from the strategic reserve was supposed to do, was lower domestic fuel prices. They're releasing more than a million barrels fuel a day, or and then they're releasing 5 million barrels to foreign countries, and they're not, it's not accomplishing the task. Like, this is incompetence on a grandiose scale, and it's demonstrating this perverse hostility that the Biden administration has to the average American, because they're unconcerned with the energy prices. And in the midst of allegedly trying to lower domestic fuel prices, they can't even help but still divert resources to foreign countries. So it's just gross and definitely worth commenting on. But unfortunately, we've got to cut the segments short. So stay tuned for more. This is 93 WIBC. Up next, Hat Tricks with Hatcher. Stay tuned for that.
And the waitress is practicing politics as a businessman slowly gets stoned. Yes, they're sharing a drink they call loneliness.
This is Saturday Night on the Circle on 93 WIBC.
Just when approval ratings for the Biden administration reach an all-time low, things continue to get worse for the unpopular president as inquiries surrounding his son's foreign business dealings heat up, with more leaks from the infamous laptop coming to light. The administration has backed itself into a corner, unable to effectively address the accusations, and left to shallow denials and blame shifting. You'll hear the press secretary do what we've come to expect by providing no relevant details whatsoever. A growing trend from this press secretary press secretary's turn at the podium. These political leaders are taking America down a path that its greatest generation finds altogether foreign, and you'll hear the tearful remarks of a 100-year-old veteran from World War II on this week's edition of Hat Tricks with Hatcher.
It's time for another one of Hatcher's Hat Tricks.
The story you are about to see is true. The names have been changed to protect the innocent.
Listening to Saturday Night on the Circle, where I'm your host, Ethan Hatcher, and producer Carl. Beep, 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 beep. He's pushing those buttons and doing all the things on the board to make the show possible. We begin this week with White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre, who clearly knows that the game is up for Biden. The press secretary shared a defensive exchange with Fox News' Peter Doocy about the aforementioned Hunter voicemail on the laptop. It's over. Biden's goose is cooked. Everyone in the Democrat Party knows it, and you can hear the deflection from the press secretary in this exchange.
Why is there a voicemail of the president talking to his son about his overseas business dealings if the president has said he's never spoken to his son about his overseas business dealings?
Well, first I'll say that what the president said stands. So if that's what the president said, that is what stands. And
he's
second,
a voicemail
secondly,
about a New York Times article,
but secondly,
concerning Hunter
secondly,
Biden's business dealings, and he says, "I think you're clear." How is that not him talking to his son about his overseas business dealings?
We're not, from this podium, I am not going to talk about alleged materials from the laptop.
So
I will.
Are you disputing the president's voice on the voicemail?
I am not going to talk about alleged materials on the laptop.
Are
it's
you
not happening.
Then that it is not.
Peter, I refer you to his son's representative.
Oh, how the mighty have fallen, how the tables have turned, how the narrative has changed since the days that this was Russian disinformation being purveyed from shady sources. And now the contents on the laptop have been confirmed, and more details continue to emerge, painting an altogether too clear picture of the Biden's corruption and the knowledge, certainly, that his father had of his son's business dealings, enriching himself because of the connection he had to the vice president and then President Barack Obama. This is another, or well, this is Biden at the time in, I believe it was a 2018 or 2019, being grilled by a reporter in which he denied any knowledge of his son's business dealings, very blithely.
Hunter said the only thing you said to him was, quote, "I hope you know what you're doing."
That's exactly right. He's a grown man. What I meant by that is, I hope you've thought this through. I hope you know exactly what you're doing here.
Meaning what?
That's all I meant. Nothing more than that, because I've never discussed my business or their business, my sons or daughters, and I've never discussed them, because they know where I have to do my job and that's it, and they have to make their own judgments.
President Trump has said publicly, Joe Biden and his son are stone cold corrupt. And chances are he's watching this interview. Anything you want to say to him?
Yeah, Mr. President, release your tax returns. Let's see how straight you are. Okay, old buddy?
Oh, that's a laugh and a half, because of course, where there's smoke, there is fire. And that was an interview in 2019 after this exchange. This was a voicemail left as early as 2018, in which the Joe Biden is essentially revealing that he's acknowledging that he is aware of his son's business dealings.
Hey, pals, Dad, it's 8:15. On Wednesday night, if you get a chance, give me a call. Nothing urgent. Just want to talk to you. I thought the article, at least the thing on online, it's going to be printed tomorrow in the Times, was good. I think it's clear. And anyway, if you get a chance, give me a call. I love you.
That article in the Times that he's referring to was about Hunter Biden's business dealings with an energy company in China while he was sitting on the board of Burisma. So, I mean, like, this guy is dirty, dirty, dirty. And the Trump apparently had exactly right. The corruption in the Biden family is deep. Also, the incompetence. Biden, his mental faculties continue to slip. He accidentally read the teleprompter telling him to repeat his line this week and just keeps getting worse. This was the humorous moment caught on television.
It is noteworthy that the percentage of women who registered to vote and cast a ballot is consistently higher than the percentage of the men who do so. End of quote. Repeat the line. Women are not without electoral and or political or maybe precise, not and or political power.
Oh, man. Yeah. Catch that again. He read the line on the teleprompter. Biden, that's not how that works.
Than the percentage of the men who do so. End of quote. Repeat the line. Women are.
End of quote. Repeat the line. But, you know, incompetency at the highest, the most upper echelon of the administration is echoed on down, and certainly by the press secretary. She is just precious and mostly offers very little during the press briefings, repeatedly unable to answer the simplest of questions. Here's a spliced together supercut of some of the exchanges from just this week's press briefings, in which she apparently knows very little.
Well, you guys are always excited to hear what I got to say.
I don't have anything to preview for you at this time. I don't have anything to share right now, so I'm not going to get ahead of the president on that.
I don't have anything to share on that either, but I don't have any updates on that. As soon as we have something, we will share that. Can't speak to anything more besides, you know, we would refer you to the IRS on that specific thing. But look, again, I don't have anything to preview or announce at this time. I just don't have anything to read out. I can't speak to that from here. I'm not going to get ahead of the president. I actually don't have anything for you. I'm not going to get ahead of the president's decision. I'm not going to speak to it. I don't have anything for you at this time to preview. I don't have anything for you to prove for you. Again,
what
I don't have anything to share with you. I don't have anything else to read out, and I just don't
what
have anything
does
to share
this
time.
Woman know?
I don't have anything to share. I'm not going to negotiate from here. I'm not going to give a deadline from here. I don't have an executive order, executive action to speak to. So I don't have
this
any.
We
don't have any calls to read out. I don't have more to share. So I don't have anything for you to prove for you. I just don't have anything for you to share at this time. I don't have a call to preview for you. We just don't have more to share.
Carl,
I don't have any.
All right. That's enough. It could go for 50 more seconds. That was just from this week. Do you get the point? Do you understand? This is a problem. If you thought strawberry-haired Circleback Psaki, Jen Psaki, was a disaster, Karine Jean-Pierre, guys, can we not pick roles for the administration based solely on shallow qualifiers? You know, let's actually pick some people based on the merits for their appointment. My goodness, where did you drag this woman out? Does she have a communication degree? Where did she come from? She doesn't sit. Maybe this isn't a problem with her. Maybe this is the fact that the administration isn't giving her enough material to be able to effectively communicate with the body of the press. I mean, I don't know what other conclusion we're supposed to derive here, but it is a clown show. And for those people who used to laugh at Sarah Huckabee Sanders, she exhibited a far greater mastery of the press room than either of these last two idiots who Biden has appointed for the position. That said, America does seem to be circling the drain and going downhill. We all can kind of feel it in our bones, and none better than the greatest generation. This was shared on the Daily Wire, and an interview with a 100-year-old World War II veteran. He did an interview with Tampa Bay in Fox Channel 13 of Fox. And he essentially said exactly that America is going down the drains. Here was his interview.
I sincerely believe in this old world that everything is beautiful. I mean, if I wake up in the morning and see these plants out here and all those flowers that are in there and the green grass on the ground, that's beautiful. And people don't realize what they have. They bitch about it.
They do.
And then nowadays, I am so upset that the things we did and the things we fought for and the boys that died for it, it's all gone down the drain. Our country's gone to hell in a handbasket. We haven't got the country we had when I was raised. Not at all. Nobody will have the fun I had. Nobody will have the opportunity I had. It's just not the same. And that's not what I want. That's not what they died for. It's not it. I'm so sorry.
I agree.
Just takes me time to get over it. Because I just not. It's just not the same. That isn't what we fought for. Oh, well, I should be worried about it, I guess. I'm 100 years old, they say.
Doesn't that just break your heart? That's Carl Sperling Diekel, 100-year-old World War II veteran. And yeah, you know, I think he is giving voice to what many people feel in their bones. Something's not right. We were talking about it with Guy Relford earlier in the show. The culture has fundamentally changed, and it seems that society is wounded, for lack of a better term. And I'm not sure how we dig ourselves out of that. Not sure how we fix the problem. But certainly one method would be by participating in the system that we do have to try and improve the world that we currently live in. And I guess that's where we're going to end the segment, because once again, I find myself over time. But thanks for tuning in to Saturday Night on The Circle. Stay tuned for more on 93 WIBC. We got another segment to go and a whole hour after that. Stay tuned.
Life is just a bowl of cherries. Don't be so serious. Life's too mysterious.
This is Saturday Night on The Circle on 93 WIBC.
When you go, go, go. So keep repeating.
Welcome back to the show. This is Saturday Night on The Circle. I'm your host, Ethan Hatcher. If you've missed a moment of the show, catch the podcast uploaded to SaturdayNightOnTheCircle.fireside.fm. I put it up every Sunday, and you can catch all my past appearances and guest appearances, filling in for Tony Katz today, filling in on the Kendall and Casey and other shows. So catch all that uploaded to SaturdayNightOnTheCircle.fireside.fm. And Carl, we came real close this week to losing a musical legend. The Heat came damn close to knocking out 74-year-old rock legend Carlos Santana performing Tuesday night at Pine Knob Music Theater in Clarkson. He collapsed because of dehydration. I mean, it's already hot, and the temperatures were in excess of 100 degrees up on that stage. And you know it has to be intense to take down the man who once belted out one of the most memorable guitar solos in all of rock history at Woodstock while high on LSD and mescaline at the same time. That's incredible. And you know, not enough to take him down. Of course, he was 22 and now he is 74. But you know, what really brought to my mind is the fact that we have precious few of these icons left. They're all getting up there You know, I mean, their heyday was in the 60s, the 70s, and then now these people are in their 70s and their 80s. Ringo Starr also turning 82 on Thursday this week, celebrating his birthday in the traditional way. It's been a tradition now for more than a few years. I don't know when it started, but Ringo Starr wants you to throw two hands up in the air and give a peace sign for world joy. It's Ringo Starr. And of course, Paul McCartney is also still kicking around. He is 80 years old, and he told Peace to the World on Ringo's birthday, same day as my dad, two very special men, indeed. Who would have thought that Paul and Ringo would be the two that were still kicking around? But yeah, anyway, so these guys are all getting up there, and life is short, but certainly they have lived a full one. For being rock stars, you don't typically think of those as being long-lived individuals, and that's why there are so precious few of them left. Thank goodness the Heat didn't take out Carlos Santana this week. But we did have a couple deaths, including Tony Sirico, best known for his turn as Polly Walnuts on The Sopranos, and also for this memorable line on Family Guy.
Hey, Family Guy, you're lucky I got a man of gut in the oven, or I'd bash your face into a bolognese. That's two kinds of food. That's how angry I am.
He was born in 1942, according to his profile, first appearing on screen in 1977, dying at age 79. And also another, not a star, but related to a star, One Tree Hill star Bevan Prince. She's suffering through the devastating loss of her husband, who was struck by lightning. According to a local report, William Friend was near Masonboro Island in North Carolina last weekend when he was hit by a lightning strike. He was a CEO of BizNow, a digital media company, and he was only 33 years old. He was a friend. There was a friend on the scene who attempted to perform CPR for over 20 minutes, but it just wasn't enough, and he passed away. And I can't think of anything. I mean, not necessarily more gruesome, but you know, what a one-off, like what a one in a million chance, literally, to describe something like getting struck by lightning. And that's what happened to this guy. He was struck by lightning, and now he, you know, leaving behind a widow. And again, only at age 33 years old. What a incredible turn of events. So we've had some passings. Of course, we had a birthday celebration, and Carlos Santana survived his incident on stage at Pine Knob Music Theater. Stay tuned to Saturday Night on The Circle. We've got a lot more content to come. Coming up in the next hour, we will cover the saga you've been aching to hear, and that is the resignation of Boris Johnson. Again, how the mighty have fallen, where once based Boris was ushered in with an enormous mandate from the people of England. Now he has ignobly resigned in disgrace, engulfed by scandals of his own making. And I'll tell you all about it, and also the enigma and the charm that was Johnson, coming up next on 93 WIBC.
Time goes slowly, but it carries on. And now the best years have come and gone. You took me by surprise.
This is Saturday Night on The Circle on 93 WIBC.
Welcome back to hour two of Saturday Night on The Circle. Got a lot of crazy stuff to cover this hour, including the very tragic assassination of Shinzo Abe, the former prime minister of Japan, who was assassinated during a political speech by a lone nutcase with a homemade gun, which just goes to show, even in countries with the tightest of gun control, not going to catch all of them, and you're not going to stop criminals who truly have the intent to do harm, as was the case here. My name is Ethan Hatcher, by the way. Thanks for tuning in. That's producer Carl on the board, beep, 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 pushing those buttons, doing the things necessary to make the show run ever so smoothly. And if you missed a moment of the program, catch my podcast uploaded to Saturday Night on thecircle.fireside.fm. Saturday night on the circle .fireside.fm. Beginning this hour, oh, how the mighty have fallen. Prime Minister Boris Johnson, he has been somewhat internationally prominent since 2016. He was elected prime minister with a large commanding majority in 2019, the largest conservative majority in the country since the mid-80s, I believe. And since that time, he has squandered the goodwill that he arrived in on. He kind of had an affable charm that many compared in some ways to the charisma of Donald Trump. They had similar appeals. They were outsiders, and they connected with the common man communicating for them. Britain's prime minister officially resigning on Thursday after a scandal-ridden administration ultimately coming to a head, speaking in front of 10 Downing Street, where he took where many of his predecessors also voiced resignation addresses. He announced he would be stepping down without actually saying the words out loud. This was on Thursday, Johnson's resignation, or a portion of that speech.
My friends, in politics, no one is remotely indispensable. And our brilliant and Darwinian system will produce another leader equally committed to taking this country forward through tough times, not just helping families to get through it, but changing and improving the way we do things, cutting burdens on businesses and families, and yes, cutting taxes, because that is the way to generate the growth and the income we need to pay for great public services. And to that new leader, I say, whoever he or she may be, I say, I will give you as much support as I can. And to you, the British public, I know that there will be many people who are relieved, and perhaps quite a few who will also be disappointed. And I want you to know how sad I am to be giving up the best job in the world. But them's the breaks.
It took nearly 60 members of his government to resign from their positions, almost half the payroll, for Johnson to finally abandon his attempts to cling to power and ultimately step down. Some figures within his party say even his decision to remain until a new leader is selected will ultimately be untenable because there's a dwindling number of people who are even willing to work with him. UK Foreign Secretary Liz Truss said Johnson had made the right decision to resign.
We need calmness and unity right now and to keep governing while a new leader is found, she added.
The leader of the opposition Labour Party, Keir Starmer, said it was good news for the country that Johnson decided to resign, and it should have happened a long time ago. He was always unfit for office. He's been responsible for lies, scandal, and fraud on an industrial scale. That's what he posted on Twitter. This is a history with Johnson, and I was going through some old episodes. I was just talk about a random coincidence. I was going through old episodes of Last Week Tonight with that incredible liberal dunderhead John Oliver. But boy, did he call Boris Johnson circa 2019 in this episode, which went on to kind of pull back the curtain on Boris Johnson's charm and appeal, and kind of reveal some of that.
Boris learned at an early age the benefits of making yourself the butt of the joke, as his own sister remembers.
He discovered he could make people laugh when he was in a French play and he had to recite Molière, and he hadn't bothered to learn his lines, and he hid behind a pillar reading them out, which was obviously much funnier than if he'd learnt them perfectly and had stood on the stage and declaimed them.
Yeah, obviously. It's always funnier when things go wrong. Boris actually learned a great deal from that incident, as he himself will admit.
Do you think that you learnt something for later life from acting in plays at Eton, that you could actually get more laughs by looking as if you don't know your lines than actually remembering them?
Well, I certainly think that as a general tactic in life, if that's what you're driving at, It is often useful to give the slight impression that you are deliberately pretending not to know what is going on, because the reality may be that you don't know what is going on, but people won't be able to tell the difference.
And that, right there, is the key to Boris Johnson, presenting his own lack of preparation so charmingly that you actually doubt he's unprepared, but he is.
And I mean, this goes all the way back to affable, lovable, moppy-headed Boris Johnson when he was the mayor of London, waving the Union Jack on that zip line when he got stuck. And, you know, these sort of political moments that would have taken down other people, he managed to live through them in stride because he took on that role of being kind of, you know, that jovial, jokey kind of guy. And he leaned into it. He'd muss up his hair before interviews for the purpose of evoking that relatability. And mind you, this individual drew many comparisons during his tenure and prior to the former president now, Donald Trump. And see if this rings a few bells, too. This is Boris Johnson just prior to the Brexit deal being finalized, and whether or not he ultimately had a trade deal with the EU, and he was insistent that he would be able to establish that after the fact, but he didn't have, it turns out, all his facts correct, and was being challenged by a journalist in this exchange. And again, remember, Boris Johnson understands that in some cases it's more beneficial to give the appearance that you don't know what you're talking about, because sometimes you don't. And this was one of those times.
One of his great plans for mitigating the potentially catastrophic effects of a no-deal Brexit is to suggest that if the UK misses that October deadline, it could simply trade freely with the EU under Article 24, paragraph 5b of this existing trade agreement. But, and you do not need to know the details of this, the very next paragraph, 5c, makes it clear that that is simply not possible. And just watch as a journalist who actually understood that challenged Johnson on it.
You talk about Article 5b. In
paragraph
24.
Article 24. Get the detail
Article
right.
5,
get the detail right, Andrew. It's Article 24, paragraph 5.
And how would you handle paragraph 5C?
I would confide entirely in paragraph 5B, because that is...
So how would you get around what's in 5C?
I would confide entirely in paragraph 5B, which is
do you know what's
enough
in 5C?
For our purposes. No.
Oh, for f***'s sake! That no was delivered with the confidence of a man who doesn't know what he's talking about, but thinks it doesn't matter.
And so ultimately, the weight of his lack of preparedness and the scandal within the administration caused his collapse. Whether that was questions over the finances to his holiday in Mystique in early 2020, or who paid for the expensive refurbishments to Downing Street, or the, this rings a few bells too, COVID contracts were awarded at the height of the pandemic, and whether Tory donors and associates were given preferential treatment. Questions about his own party and how Mr. Johnson was handling a range of other problems, from queues at petrol stations and shortages of taxi drivers to picking fights that he was unlikely to win, and also tax raises in the party, which were unpopular, to pay for the NHS backlog and social care. With each mishandling, further questions were raised over his judgment and his style of leadership. Also, the parties that took place in Downing Street during the pandemic, and also his endorsement of Chris Pincher after he allegedly sexually assaulted two men in full sight of several other Tory leaders. So, I mean, this was a complete disaster, and his lack of foresight ultimately led to the downfall of the administration in a quite ignoble fashion. And now another leader is being sought. Also, in the wake of this, as one leader steps down, former Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe died after being shot in the street of Nara yesterday in an act of violence that usually isn't seen in the country with the world's lowest rate of gun crime. Abe was shot at about 11:30 a.m. local time east of Osaka as he was giving election campaign speech on the street. And the nutcase, Tetsuya Yamagami, who shot him, did so because of an alleged connection to a religious group that ruined the life of his mother. And apparently that's completely spurious, but again, it goes to show when these deranged nutcases seek to inflict harm, they will find a way, as was the case here, resulting in his demise. I believe the longest serving prime minister there in Japan. And with his passing, of course, many world leaders have offered their condolences. It took Biden a minute, but he did ultimately step up to the plate and offer some words that were doubtlessly pre-prepared and scrutinized prior to release. But there you go. You're listening to 93 WIBC Saturday Night on The Circle. We got a lot more content to come, including the exciting announcement that Elon Musk has terminated the $44 billion Twitter deal. You knew it was coming down the pike, the old pump and dump. Elon. Anyway, we'll talk about that coming up next. So stay tuned to 93 WIBC.
All the moon men want things their way.
But you're listening to Saturday Night on the Circle on 93 WIBC.
Goodbye.
Welcome back to Saturday Night on the Circle. I'm your host, Ethan Hatcher. Producer Carl on the board. And Elon Musk, oh, you crafty bastard. He has officially backed out of the $44 billion Twitter deal, much to the dismay of the Twitter board.
You're a crafty one, Elon Musk. You really are a heel. You bought you offered $44 billion for Twitter and then backed out of the deal.
Elon Musk. Anyway, yeah, he's a interesting cat. And so this is an old pump and dump. He invested in the company. He already had stock. He built up anticipation about this purchase, increasing the value, and then sold some assets. And yeah, and so now he's backing out of the deal, ostensibly because of not accurately reporting the bots. According to Twitter chairman Brett Taylor, he said on Twitter that the Twitter board is committed to closing the transaction on the price and terms agreed upon with Mr. Musk and plans to pursue legal action to enforce the merger agreement. We are confident that we will prevail in the Delaware Court of Chancery. Musk's lawyers say that Twitter failed or refused to respond to the multiple requests for information on fake spam accounts on the platform, which is fundamental to the company's business performance. Quote, Twitter is in material breach of multiple provisions of that agreement and appears to have made false and misleading representations upon which Mr. Musk relied when entering into the merger agreement. Shares of Twitter were down 6% at $34.58 in extended trading, 36% below the $54.20 per share that Musk had agreed to buy Twitter for back in April. So yeah, this has been much ado about nothing, ultimately. Germinating excitement about the purchase, increasing spuriously the value of the stock, and then backing out of the deal. Some would say that it was almost predictable. You're listening to Saturday Night on The Circle. If you missed a moment of the show, catch the podcast uploaded to Saturday Night on The Circle.fireside.fm. Given the climate of contentious mass shootings and crime across the country, this is a questionable campaign ad that's been released by a Republican candidate in Arizona, a congressional candidate for the 4th District, who's used in the ad an AR-15 to scare off whom he describes as Democrats dressed as Ku Klux Klan members. And this is what's been passed around, certainly in viral media.
Democrats like to say that no one needs an AR-15 for self-defense, that no one could possibly need all 30 rounds. But when this rifle is the only thing standing between your family and a dozen angry Democrats in Klan hoods, you just might need that semi-automatic and all 30 rounds.
That's Jerome Davison for Arizona's 4th District, who is seen praying in the ad and wielding an AR-15 to scare off these Democrats and KKK outfits. So, you know, of course, political speech and religious speech are given the highest levels of protection under the Constitution as interpreted by the Supreme Court. So he's certainly free to do what he's whatever he wishes. And there has been much worse published in campaign ads. But that being said, this maybe seems like a questionable decision. Not quite as bad as that chap who said there was open season on rhinos and then proceeded to bear a firearm in the ad. But that's a separate matter entirely. I also wanted to point to Bill O'Reilly. He had this questionable take following the massacre at Highland Park, ultimately by, you know, a troubled young white man. Ultimately, in this outburst, shifting the blame to minority gangs for the crime in Chicago after that incident.
You, JB, are not going to stop the loons, and you won't stop crime, drug gangs, because they're minority gangs. That's why you won't stop them, you phony. You aid and abet this murder in Chicago every blanking day. You! Don't be sanctimonious with me.
Yeah, so that's Bill O'Reilly, who lost his crap after Governor Pritzker addressed the Highland Park shooting, and there was his response. It seems to me like these were largely unrelated issues, but Bill O'Reilly's career continues to circle the drain, which is a sad state of affairs for a man who, you know, previously was one of the best-selling authors in America. You're listening to Saturday Night on the Circle. Stay tuned. We've got a lot more content to come. Up next, I'm going to have a conversation, replaying my discussion, as a matter of fact, with Rob Kendall and Tony Kennett. I appeared this week on Wednesday on the Kendall and Casey program, and we discussed a very dubious handout from the Indiana Republican Party to their buddies on the Bar Association, and we'll give you the details on that coming up next on 93 WIBC.
This is Saturday Night on The Circle on 93 WIBC.
Let me take you on a little trip, my supersonic.
Welcome back to the show. We're wrapping things up on a busy Saturday evening. I appreciate you taking time out of your schedule to spend with me, your host, Ethan Hatcher. This week, I stopped into the WIBC studios to chat with my buddy Rob Kendall, who invited me onto the Kendall and Casey program. Casey was out, but Tony Kennett from Chalkboard Review, he was sitting in. And together, we three discussed this frankly ridiculous handout from the Indiana General Assembly. And let's all be honest with ourselves. The Indiana Republican Party, a handout to their buddies on the Bar Association. So if you missed this conversation on Wednesday, I wanted to revisit the discussion for tonight's program.
Our friends over at the Indiana Capital Chronicle had a really interesting new piece on how the lieutenant governor for the state of Indiana, Suzanne Crouch, has made a big announcement on Tuesday, teaming up with the Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority to announce spending $13.1 million with the Indiana Bar Foundation to provide legal services for Hoosiers facing eviction. And while that might sound like some sort of feel-good thing on the surface, the reality is this seems like one of the worst ways to use our money, because eviction is a private legal dispute between two people, usually involving a renter who is mad the rentee won't give them their money. And so I said, look, I'm not a trained expert on this, but I know someone who is. And you can hear him every Saturday night, 7 to 9 p.m. Saturday night on The Circle, Ethan Hatcher. Ethan, am I wrong on this? You own several properties on the east side. These are not McMansions. You're not making millions of dollars off this. Am I wrong on this by saying this is a terrible use of money to essentially make it harder for you to get the money that's entitled to you?
This is laughable and cartoonish. It's a waste of time on the part of the Republican Party. Mind you, this is the same Indiana Republican Party that can't find it within their heart to give you nary a 3-month break on your gas tax, but they do have nearly $13.5 million to give i.e. to their buddies on the Bar Association. Yeah. They're not preventing anybody from being evicted here. And mind you, this is from, what'd you say, the Housing and Community Development?
Yes, Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority.
What houses or community does this develop by giving a $13 million handout to a bunch of lawyers? You know what they could have done is given it to rental assistants. If they're just going to give a handout, pay their bills. That's usually why tenants are being evicted, because I'll tell you what, coming from the housing provider's perspective, it doesn't do us any favors to put our properties back on the market and have them sitting vacant.
Well, you were pointing out like what you rent these homes for, and you do a nice job. I think utilities are included in a lot of these. Like, you're, what, it was like $700 a month you were charging someone?
Yes, $750 a month to, I'm getting ready to increase the rent from $700 to $900 on a three-bedroom, single-family home with air conditioning.
Three-bedroom in New York.
In Indianapolis.
In New York City, a 5-square-foot apartment, the smallest apartment in New York City. That is not an exaggeration, by the way.
What? There's no way.
Oh, yeah, I'm serious. There's a whole Instagram video about it that I just watched this morning. $1,200 a month.
Right.
But so here's the point. Okay, so one, this money, you are a law-abiding, tax-paying citizen. You file forms. You do everything the right way. They are now saying, again, clarify, you're not looking to kick people out of your properties,
no,
right?
No, I would rather people stay and pay. There's the two qualifiers. Stay there and pay me. And as long as you're not causing problems for other tenants or the neighborhood, why would I want you to leave?
And if your tenant doesn't pay, and you can expand on this, you ran into this during COVID when Lockdown McGee forbid you from kicking people out of their who don't pay. The bank doesn't come to you and go, "Oh, Mr. Hatcher, we understand your tenant is refusing to pay. No mortgage due this month."
Yeah, that's not how it works. Also not how property tax works. You better believe that Marion County was there for their property tax.
You know, and that's a really good point, because you were talking about this false, hypocritical, sanctimonious nature that the Indiana Republican Party has put forward in the last couple of years. Let's take a look at the constitutional carry bill. They have the audacity to come out and say, "We are taking a step back. We don't believe the government should be telling you what to do or should be like really intervening in your private life and your private rights." But all of a sudden, when it comes to managing the property that I own, you're funding people to sue me directly from the state budget? How on earth is that acceptable?
We already have a version of these services that are currently available, and I've seen how this works firsthand at the Marion County Small Claims Court, and they do provide legal advice and counsel to those who seek it, sometimes on the day of eviction. And 9 times out of 10, they're not able to stop the process because it's a lawful eviction. They're delinquent by sometimes multiple months or more with other extenuating factors to combine. So they're not preventing people from being evicted.
Real quick, introduce the voice you're hearing there. It's the Kendall Casey Show. I'm Rob. Casey's out today. Tony Kennett in for Casey. Ethan Hatcher's with us. He owns several properties on the east side that he rents at a very reasonable price. And we're talking with Ethan today because the state of Indiana, the Republican Party, the Holcomb administration, has come out bragging that they are spending $13.1 million partnering with the Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority to essentially provide it. I always love this when they talk about, we're going to provide, air quote, free legal service. Like,
wow.
No, it's not free. If it were free, you wouldn't be spending $13.1 million to essentially gum up, slow down, make it impossible for small business owners like Ethan. Because let's face it, many, many, many of these properties are not mega corporation. Some of them are, but I would guess the majority of them are people like you. Hey, I own 5 houses and I rent them out.
Although that's an unfortunately dwindling number because of the economic environment that Hightax Holcomb has sponsored, inviting out-of-state investment that is gobbling up a lot of good properties in Indianapolis. And I promise you, if you don't like your small private landlord, you will hate your corporate out-of-state overlord. I promise.
How ironic it is that by portraying the small town local landlord as Mr. Monopoly and Mr. Burns, they have somehow invited in actual Mr. Burns to come in and run the properties.
Now, you've told the story before, because I was doing the award-winning Rob Kendall Show Sundays on WIBC during the first year of the pandemic, before they wised up around here and they said, we got to have this guy on every single day. But you and I were talking at length at the time about the amount of money you lost during COVID.
Something like $40,000.
Yeah, like there was some
deal, insubstantial for a small business.
There was some deal at one of your houses. It was a plumbing issue or something where you couldn't just say, well, you're not paying, so too bad I can't afford to fix this plumbing issue. Like, they would have condemned the home, taken the home, whatever. It was like tens of thousands of dollars you were telling me you were forced to do from some guy who wasn't even paying the rent.
Yeah, well, in those circumstances, like, you're still required, and that's illustrative of the problem. You were still legally obligated to pay utilities and provide maintenance for tenants who, in some circumstances, were paying absolutely nothing at all. And at a time when the money was literally just being given away for these rental assistance programs, there was no impetus for the tenants to apply for them. So there were these articles that were written, I thought were hilarious, by the media that kind of demonized property owners who weren't accepting the rental assistance. Guys, this came usually like when the evictions came was when some of these people applied. And at that point, you're months and months and months and months delinquent. You've already had the opportunity. No, we're not playing that game. And it also stipulated that you couldn't evict them after receiving the assistance.
We talked about the Adam Wren, who does the Importville website, did an article on Suzanne Crouch's chance for governor. And he asked me to do a quote. And I said, she got no shot because while she's very likable in person, she can raise infinite money. She is totally linked at the hip to Holcomb because she's been completely silent.
And when given opportunities to criticize very horrible moves that he made, she remained completely silent. And I mean, you know, you can say, well, there's an element of loyalty there and whatever. But when you're planning on running for governor, if you're planning on running for governor, you have to hold the current administration accountable because you are running to change the status of the state. And I certainly don't want to elect whatever this garbage is. If you think I want to put a million Hoosiers currently renting in huge high corporate pockets so that we can screw over our small business owners, you got another thing coming.
Well, this is the point. They act, she's out there being the face of this. Clearly, nobody put a gun to her head. She must think this is a good idea.
No, she's advocating it with a smile.
Yeah, it's just, it's egregious. And, you know, look, I'm closer to this, and maybe I feel as passionate about it as I do because I know Ethan, and I know what a good job he does. But there's Ethan's all over the place.
I lived in a small family managed my apartment building when I lived in Greenfield back when I was single. And they are the exact individuals who would be crushed by this kind of nonsense.
What's coming up this Saturday night, Saturday on the Circle?
Don't have any big plans for the show yet. I'll be putting that together probably tomorrow and Friday. So stay tuned for that. But there is one thing I'd like to encapsulate for this segment before we go.
Yes.
And that's three things. First of all, this eviction legal assistance doesn't prevent anybody from getting evicted in point of fact. And also, coming from the Housing and Community Development whatever authority, it doesn't develop any housing or any community.
But
so
it
there
says
you go.
Development in the title. Are you telling me the Democratic People's Republic of North Korea is neither democratic nor of the people?
Go figure.
The one and only Ethan Hatcher, thank you for lending your expertise on this, because otherwise it's just me being mean. But when we have experts on, people go, oh, that was a great segment. You guys made a lot of sense.
It was awesome getting to come onto the Kendall and Casey program and share a conversation with Rob and Tony Kennett. And I think the most disappointing thing that our discussion revealed ultimately is how far the Indiana Republican Party has strayed from the values of fiscal responsibility, fiscal conservatism, and limited governance, which in the past, in the far distant past, used to be core Republican values, but no longer reflected in our state governance, unfortunately. You're listening to Saturday Night on the Circle. If you miss a moment, catch my podcast uploaded to saturdaynightonthecircle.fireside.fm. saturdaynightonthecircle.fireside.fm. Stay tuned to 93 WIBC.
On 93 WIBC.
Because those dear
hey, welcome back to the show. This is Saturday Night on the Circle, and I'm just wrapping things up here on a Saturday evening. Hey, thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to listen to the show. I realize that there's a lot more that you could be doing on a Saturday evening than tuning in to listen to a political talk show on Indianapolis radio. So when you choose to spend your Saturday evenings with me, truly, your support means just that much more. So thanks for listening. And thank you, producer Carl, for beep, 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 pushing those buttons and doing all the things necessary to make the show run smoothly. I appreciate your hard work as always. Now, before we end the program officially, I wanted to end the evening on a bit of a positive note, some silver lining to the dark cloud that overcasts our existence. And of course, you've been hearing now for a couple decades from climate scientists who have been warning about the impending doom that increasing temperatures and global warming poses to the ongoing existence of humanity. But I'm here to tell you, dear listener, that we have a way out. There's a means to reverse the encroachment of increasing temperatures. This, according to researchers at Louisiana State University. we can get out of global warming through nuclear winter. Ta-da! Okay, so maybe that's not the salvation I advertised it to be, but nevertheless, it is prescient to discuss because doomsday threats have been emanating against the West by Vladimir Putin since the invasion of Ukraine, threatening to flex his muscles and nuke the United States into oblivion. Although largely those appear to be vacuous threats, it does harken back to a time of nuclear paranoia that we endured for several decades during the Cold War, and we really not like a return to that, but it does call to mind the struggles of the past. Now, new research suggests that if there ever were to be a nuclear war between Russia and the United States, it would trigger this little ice age, which would last for thousands of years and buy us time out of global warming. Hooray! Firestorms would release soot and smoke into the upper atmosphere that would block out the sun and result in crop failure around the world, thus thinning the population and making long-term sustainability even more viable. I'm being sarcastic. I hope you realize this. In the first month following detonation, average global temperatures would plunge by about 13 degrees Fahrenheit. And guess what? It doesn't matter who's getting bombed. This is according to the lead author of the paper, Dr. Cheryl Harrison, there of Louisiana State University. It could be India. It could be Pakistan, NATO, and Russia. Once the smoke is released into the upper atmosphere, it would spread globally and affect everyone. The analysis shows that ocean temperatures would drop quickly and not return to their pre-war state even after the smoke cleared. As the planet got colder, sea ice would expand by more than 6 million square miles and up to 6 feet deep, which would block major ports including Beijing, Copenhagen, and St. Petersburg. So those of you who've been worried about the shrinking ice caps, it would all come back. So in order to stymie the encroachment and oncoming doom opposed by global warming, we just need to unleash nuclear winter and a nuclear war. Kind of reminds me of the Fallout series, if any of you are familiar with that. Great game series, by the way.
In the year 2077, after millennia of armed conflict, the destructive nature of man could sustain itself no longer. The world was plunged into an abyss of nuclear fire and radiation. But it was not, as some had predicted, the end of the world. Instead, the apocalypse was simply the prologue to another bloody chapter of human history. For man had succeeded in destroying the world. But war never changes.
So if you've ever wanted to live action role play the Fallout series, nuclear war between the United States and Russia is your chance. I mean, I think the game predicted nuclear war between China and the United States, but you get the idea. Same thing. You're listening to Saturday Night on the Circle. I'm your host, Ethan Hatcher, just wrapping things up for the evening. And if you ever wanted to see the effects of green radiation on your skies, well, we had a little bit of a preview of that in the sky around Sioux Falls in Dakota this week. I mean, this is wild. Severe weather had been decimating the state, and that's when these green skies occur. Many users on Twitter and Facebook took to social media, uploading the green skies above their city, and it was creepy. Truly, something otherworldly, ethereal, something that you'd see out of a movie, like when an alien invasion happens or when the Wicked Witch of the West arrives out of Wizard of Oz. That said, I can't imagine bearing witness to this firsthand. One user described the scene like something straight out of Netflix's Stranger Things, which, if you've seen that series, is a fairly apt description. These neon green skies were otherworldly, and if you were there first person, would be terrifying to bear witness to. Now, that said, it's not entirely clear what causes green skies, and some associate these with tornadic activity, but that's not necessarily the case. According to Scientific American, again, it's not clear why green skies occur, but If a thunderstorm does occur during a time of red light like a sunset, the water particles in the air can make it appear as if the sky is slightly green in color. The gray cloud of a thunderstorm, water particles bend red light to appear blue, and ample red light in the sky can create the perfect storm for a green sky, which again is not associated necessarily with tornadic activity, but does indicate that there is severe weather afoot, which the citizens of Sioux Falls, South Dakota got to witness firsthand. And with that, that's all I got for this week's edition of Saturday Night on the Circle. Hey, thanks for tuning in. And if you missed a moment, catch the podcast uploaded to saturdaynightonthecircle.fireside.fm, saturdaynightonthecircle.fireside.fm. And I leave you with my parting words of wisdom as always. Wherever you are, whoever you're with, whatever you're doing, remember that life is a state of mind. And I'll see you next week.